to a special edition of What's on Joe Mind, where we take a few moments to talk to a pair of old friends of the program, Larry Hama and Mark Chang. These two fine gentlemen have been on multiple times in the past. We wanted to get them on again to talk about their latest new project, Ghost Source Zero, which just launched this week via Kickstarter. Larry and Mark, welcome back to the show.
Hiya.
Thanks for having us.
How you guys doing?
Very good. Very excited.
Absolutely.
You should be very excited.
Frankly, I'm surprised they still admit to knowing us.
Thanks for having us back, you guys.
Anytime, anytime.
You guys say the word, you're on.
Absolutely.
Oh, we'll kick Chuck off for the night. You guys are in.
So I guess just to kind of kick things off a little bit, just give us a little background. Give us a genesis of kind of how Ghost Source Zero came to be where it is right now.
Back in the day when Operation Red Retrieval had just launched, the fans were kind of chiming in and I was getting all sorts of messages. A couple of my G.I. Joe friends, cosplayers, were telling me that I should reach out to Larry Hama and send him like the movie and let him know because they thought it was good enough. It was Larry Hama worthy. I was like, I have no idea how I would even begin to reach out to this guy. And they're like, he's on Facebook, dude. So I sent Larry a message and we exchanged messages. We talked for a little while and it turns out that I work in the city and he lives in the city. I had no idea. Larry, I think we tried to like get together for a screening, but I think you had like a last minute IDW deadline or something and you couldn't make it.
Yeah, so, I can't remember.
And so I
can't remember last week. So
I'm just going to make this up and Larry's going to be like, oh yeah, that did happen. But ultimately, like, I got the movie to him and I was really nervous because I told myself that it's like a date, like wait 1 week to call, you know, like preparing myself for the crush. But no, Larry was very graceful and said that he enjoyed it a lot. Somewhere through that conversation, we decided we could get together and over burgers and meet for lunch one day. As you see in the Kickstarter video, it was just a great time where I realized we had hit it off. And at the end, you know, I kind of threw it out there and said, hey, what would it be like if we made a movie together, you know?
Mark, not every Joe fan gets to eat ice cream with Larry Hama, okay?
It was frozen yogurt.
That's a different story. All the Joe fans eat frozen yogurt with Larry Hama.
Yeah, I think I bought the burgers, and as we were walking out, Larry saw a frozen yogurt truck, and he was like, frozen yogurt! And I was like, yeah. And then the next thing I know, he's crossing the street, so I like run after him, and he's like, come on. To buy you an ice cream. And I was like, this is just the trippiest, coolest thing ever that Larry's buying me ice cream. So that's how it started. Larry, if you remember, we traded material and kind of like kicked around a whole bunch of different ideas. And then we settled on this one script that I had been working on for a while that I kind of needed help with. You know, I liked the premise a lot. And Larry took it with him. If I remember correctly, he took it with him over a weekend when he went to a Comic-Con, one of the Comic-Cons. I remember the email because I will never forget it, that he sent me an email on a Sunday and he said, or a Saturday, I'm in the hotel room and I just finished the script and I think it's really brilliant. I think we can really do something with this. Brain explosion, and that's kind of how it started.
Excellent.
But
yes.
It needed work.
Well, of course it needed work. You know, it needed Larry's magic, and so that it's been fantastic working together.
You know, my contribution is basically causing a lot of like aggravation. I basically like to tear things apart and put them back together, because you know the basic thing that has always been my case is that I care less about the plot than I care about building the characters so that they sort of stand up and walk around. Lots of times it's really hard to make that balance in a story, you know, to have an interesting plot and have the characters be likable or people that you care about or want to find out more about. And the problem with a lot of movies is that because of how they're put together, the stages of like, you know, getting a script and then parsing that script and then making that script shootable, there's so much that goes into fixing, quote, fixing, unquote, that script that has to do with plot points. And you notice that whenever you get something like that critiqued, it's all about, oh, this character arc and blah, 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 and act one and act two and act three. And it degenerates into this whole thing about the plot and choreography, and the characters are reduced to following this choreography to make the plot make sense rather than being people that you care about. Boy, did that go off track.
But, I mean, I think that's perfect the way Larry put it. And that's been one of the, you know, that's one of like, it's definitely been one of the magical parts about us working on this together. And I think it's also one of those things that a lot of like casual viewers of movies and, you know, even comic books and written stories don't quite understand, like how tricky it can be and how, I mean, hard it can be. And then when somebody is so good at it, you can almost take it for granted. There'll be times where, I mean, to Larry's point, that he'll say, you know, I don't think this character's working. And then, you know, we go back to the story and I'm like, but they have to have this type, you know, the relationship X, Y, Z, just so this plot point will work, you know. And then we'll go back and forth and Larry, you know, and we'll each take sides and we'll deconstruct it and say, well, you know, why does that have to happen? And if that doesn't happen, then, you know, what else could happen? And it's hard to, I don't know, sometimes it's hard to conceptualize it without giving away too much of the details. But that has been like the past year and a half of Larry and I sitting down and working through the script in that way, you know. And we try to figure out whether, well, if they don't have that personality and that event can't happen, then and we've removed that event, then how do we get to, you know, I'm making this up, the next action scene? How do we set up the next action scene so it doesn't just seem like pause for them to get the briefcase?
I think that those are great points, because, you know, something that kind of resonated with me is, as Larry was talking, is just, he's right. I mean, I don't have obviously nearly the experience he does with getting feedback from producers and things like that. But yeah, I could totally see all these recommendations for, you know, change this part of the plot, this part of the plot, this event. But if you're not changing and evolving the characters to go along with it, you know, the character you started with who was doing very specific things, suddenly that character is doing very different things, yet has stayed the same as he was originally. So now you've got this character that doesn't necessarily fit the events that are surrounding him or her, just because as the events have evolved, the character has not evolved. And I can really picture films that I've seen recently where it seemed like this character was designed to do this, but ended up doing this, which doesn't really fit what personality of that character that you thought you might be getting at the beginning. So I think that's a very interesting observation. Never really heard it described that way before.
If you stop believing that character is real, then you stop caring. Mm-hmm. You know, and as soon as you see the character forced into a situation to fulfill a need for a car chase or a need for a fist fight, then you start to see the seams. And when you see the seams, you know, the fantasy goes away. The thing about constructing a fantasy that works is that you yourself creating that fantasy have to believe in Tinkerbell, you know. Because if you stop believing in Tinkerbell, the fairy drops dead.
I think
that's the words he uses in the original story. You know, the someplace a little fairy drops dead.
Yep.
That's true.
That's like, you know, when you read that, even as a kid, you go, oh my God. And that's the core of the power of the fantasy, that if you believe this fantasy enough, you're willing to excuse an awful lot of other stuff if the core is consistent and the characters are real consistent and follow that core. As soon as you realize that they're just being moved around on a board, all that goes away, really fast. And that's what we've really been working at on this project long term, just whittling away at it and putting it back together and getting it at the point where it feels right. And, you know, that's the reason why we're doing it ourselves this way, is because the main experience I've had is that as soon as you get too much money involved, and then it gets taken away from you. It's like, oh, well, now it's like 50 million or whatever, and we can't trust that with you. We got to get somebody with a real track record.
Yeah. I mean, that's totally true. And it's kind of like a lesson we learned, not necessarily the hard way, but having to go through it ourselves, where we'd work with people, you know, investors, and they'll say, you know, this is all really good, but it's got to be a bigger budget because my lawyer's fees are going to be already like 60% of your budget, you know, for me to even come in. And then we go back and we try to redo the budget. And then they're like, yeah, this is more like it, but you guys aren't proven. You know, I want to go with someone else, or I want to make sure Hulk Hogan's in it or something like that. You know?
Yeah. It's this really vicious circle that like that everybody else wants it to be more because, you know, their percentage gets bigger.
Yeah, totally.
But, you know, if you want to control the end product and make it what you want to be, then you can't let that happen.
I wanted to add, like, before we get too far away from it, like, when it comes to writing the story and working the story, like, I think we've all been in those situations where you go out to a movie with friends and you guys walk out of the theater and you're like, wow, that was really cool, except, and then you just have this laundry list of like what sucked, what didn't work, why wasn't that guy likable, like what was that guy doing? We can all do that, and that's step one. But one of the cool, like, it is by far one of the coolest things with working with Larry is that we can do that together, and then at the end of that conversation, he'll say, "Let me take a crack at it. I'll send you some pages in a week." A week goes by, and
I forget.
six days go by, and then I call Larry like, "What the hell?" No. But really, like, yeah, a week goes by, and you get Larry pages in your Gmail, and you're like, "Oh my god!" And you know, we work with another guy, Joe, my business partner, and I'll be like, "Yo, check your inbox. We got pages," and we start reading, and we'll just be like, literally howling with laughter over the phone with each other, reading through this stuff because we're like, "Oh my god, he did it!" Step one is so much easier than step two, which is fixing it. And I think Larry, obviously, he's worked on G.I. Joe and all the other serial comics, as well as working in Hollywood as a script doctor. Like, it totally shows that he pulls through with step two.
The whole game changes as soon as you put things on their feet.
Yeah.
You know, and make the characters walk around. Because when you're just thinking of them theoretically, they're just words on paper or something, you know, but when you get them actually walking around and into a situation, you realize, oh, wait a second, he wouldn't say that in that situation.
Yeah.
I mean, even with minor characters, at one point we said, hey, Leo, there's all this stuff that's like almost just like talking heads that are like, you know, experts within the story frame, you know, explaining a point. We said, well, what? Let's get some really cool people we know to just do these.
Yeah.
You know, so we went up to like Neil Adams' studio and got him to be like.
That was awesome.
We got him to be like a computer expert.
Nice.
And he said, well, I don't really know that much about computers. Yeah, but like what we want is a guy who like is really sure of himself. You know? And is sure he knows this stuff.
And he's like, well, that's
you. Yeah. And he was perfect. He was just really natural at it. And once he started doing it, you know, you saw it, you know, and, yeah, and you got it. And you went, oh, well, that's what we could do with this. And the more you get stuff up on its feet and do it, a lot of times I write fight scenes. Like, I just get up and, like, try to go through the choreography myself. And then I realize, oh, that really wouldn't work, you know?
Or, ow, my spleen.
Right. I got to figure out a more logical. And sometimes it's as stupid as it's really hard to do that when you're going up a stairway, you know? Or, wait a second, he had that in his left hand when he started.
Do you remember that time you were showing us, like, you were showing, like, Joe and I, like, these samurai moves with your sword in your apartment, and we're like, I actually got to show it to you because I recorded it, and we're like, oh my god, he's gonna like cut like Joe's ear off because he's like waving the sword around.
That's a million hits on YouTube if you get that one up.
The Neil Adams thing was actually really cool because it was like exactly how Larry described it. Like, we just needed someone to say it out loud because especially with my dialogue, it gets a little too wordy. And in my head, I'm like, I think it's perfect, but it's way too cerebral and long and it goes on. And we went over to his place the whole time. He's like trying to read this stuff. I'm like trying to steal like doodles out of his garbage can in his office. Like, I need some Adams swag.
Nice.
We didn't have a teleprompter or anything, and it was like way too long for him to memorize. So he just basically took the gist of it and ad-libbed it.
Yeah.
And it was better because it was just him.
Yeah, exactly. And it made it easier. Larry, I don't remember. It made it easier for us to talk about that character later on because I think we were all just thinking about Neo.
Yeah. And and it gave us the idea that, you know, we could do this with a lot of characters like that, and that it takes the characters out of being just these two-dimensional concepts and gives them enough form that you can get them up and walking around and interacting with each other, and you realize all this other stuff, you know, that has nothing to do with progressing an artificial plot.
Yeah, that's true. And we had not just Neil, but we had a couple different readings for the script, you know, where we'd get I think we got a bunch of actors from Operation Red Retrieval, and we all went to Larry's and kind of sat around the table and read the script out loud. And that helped a lot, helped us figure out or identify pacing issues when something just got a little too long-winded.
Or impossible to say. Lots of times writers sit down and write dialogue. And when a human being actually tries to say that dialogue, you realize, oh my God.
That's the worst thing ever written.
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't flow off. There's no way that the best actor in the world can make that line sound like a human being said it. So having people read this stuff is always really important. Because otherwise, you end up with the cameras rolling, and that's the wrong time to find out that those lines don't work.
Yeah, that's the point. And the other thing that we should also say is that while the past year and a half, that's what Larry and I have been doing, behind closed doors, heads down on paper. But we've also been shooting a whole bunch of experimental movies, to try to figure out what works and what doesn't work, and the stuff that even the stuff that we that graduates from paper that we think works will go off and film, and then in the editing room we'll both sit down together, and that's another great place where Larry's been helping a ton in his contribution about just the pacing of things. He always reminds me, because it's absolutely true, that it's very tough to edit your own material because you fall in love with it, and something that I cut together after we filmed, he would just sit there and sometimes you'd drive me crazy, Larry, with boring, I'm bored now, I'm bored, cut that, move on. And I'm like, but that angle was so cool. And so the experimental films have been a great outlet for not only just trying out the material and honing the visual style, but I think that, the unspoken thing there too, Larry, I think you'll agree, is just figuring out how you and I work together and what each of us bring to the table. And, because I don't think either of us are that used to it.
The thing about really being self-critical and not falling in love with the footage, with every bit of it, is really important. Because how many times you sit in movie theaters and go, oh my God, this scene just went, you see a movie where every single shot goes on 2.5 seconds too long.
Yeah.
After 5 minutes of that, it drives you nuts. and I see this on TV shows all the time. It's like I can't even remember the name of this show, but I watched the first 15 minutes of it, and there was a scene that went on for 5 minutes, and it was something like 16 or 18 shots of these two characters walking down a corridor explaining the premise.
I think I remember that on your Facebook page. I think you were talking about Intelligence.
Yes.
That was bad Intelligence.
The pilot. It had this a slab bab opening that didn't make any sense, but it was just really sort of violent. And then you were subjected to these people walking down a corridor.
Is that on a major network? What show? What channel?
CBS.
Yeah, it's a major network show. And it's the guy from Lost.
It's already in danger of being canceled, reportedly. So.
Uh-oh.
I mean, the premise was silly to begin with.
He has all the world's intelligence piped into his head somehow.
I had a friend who referred to it as Chuck without the whimsy.
There's an example of something where you got a lot of money behind it. And really, you know, people who should know better looking at this thing and not seeing that the emperor is naked.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that is. Is it like not wanting to tell somebody that something sucks? Or is it?
Larry's not afraid of that, by the way.
Or delusionary, you know? When I first went to work for Wally Wood, I was like 22 years old, and I had this whole portfolio of stuff that I was like wanting to show him. And I worked for him for like a couple of weeks before I got up the nerve to ask him if I could like show him my other stuff. I said, well, can you give me some feedback on what I'm doing? And he said, listen, I'll tell you when it stops sucking.
Nice.
But at the same time, I knew that I was at some certain level just by working for him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of learning of anything has to do with being able to put aside stuff like that. I sat at the drawing table next to Neil Adams for something like 3 years.
Cool.
Nobody else wanted to sit there.
It's awesome.
Because you're like always under the eye.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very intimidating. But I thought that was like the equivalent of getting a master's degree.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because, you know, you're right there in the feedback. Is immediate, and you got to appreciate that. But that's the thing about working on this stuff is you got to really chip away at it yourself. That's another thing that Woody said that really got to me. You know, there was like one assistant who said like, "Wow, golly, Woody, it's like, how do you make it come out so good all the time?" Okay. And Woody said, "Well, I just can't stand to see it suck."
Yeah.
That's all it really is about, right?
Yeah. All joking and teasing aside, like, I think one of the great things about working with Larry is that he cares just about the idea. There's no ego there. And so, like, any initial pain that you might feel about, like, you know, him not liking idea, like, we work through it. You feel at the end of the day that the only thing that matters is that the idea is preserved and is good. You know, the integrity is there. So as hard as it might ever be, like, it's, you know, every day is getting better and it's getting awesome. So it's been very cool.
That's exactly the type of person that I like to work with. You know, because I feel that way about my own stuff. I'm just never happy with it. You know, because I think that once you start to get really happy with your own stuff, it never gets any better. Because, well, why should it?
Yeah.
You know? It's like, oh, you know, I'm the best thing since sliced bread. There's no place else to go. And you get lazy. You know, you have to keep it yourself, you know, all the time. And when you work with somebody that is already convinced that they're God's gift to whatever, that becomes really frustrating.
Yeah.
It stymies any sort of creative progress. The problem is the alternative, you know, and doing it right hurts like hell.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's masochistic.
Yeah, it's god-awful. You know? But your end result is always a lot better than self-satisfied smugness.
Yeah. And, you know, however painful it is to do it on paper, like, you can't imagine what it would be, what it's like to have to, like, cut an entire actor out of it because it's just not working. So You might as well go through, because, you know, working on a production, like, it's tough. Everyone becomes a family. Everyone, you know, in a healthy situation, like, there's a lot of trust between the director and the actors, and the entire production is like a family. And then only to get to the editing stage where you realize that for it to be a watchable product, you have to cut an entire plot line out and somebody disappears. That's painful. So you might as well do it on paper because it's going to happen anyway.
At least they didn't tell you to send it back the 3D.
Yeah.
I think there's lots of famous movies that you see that like lost characters that way.
Yeah.
And you find out about it years later and you go, oh, that's the way it happens.
Yeah.
Justin made that great point about, you know, the character development earlier about building, which is my nice way of saying he stole my idea. But Mark, I guess this question was for you, because I've watched the Kickstarter video a couple times, and you had mentioned that you had been filming test movies. So I noticed in the Kickstarter there were little snippets of action scenes here and there, and were these shot specifically for that Kickstarter, or were these like snippets from the little test movies you've been making that, and this is stuff that may not make it into the final product?
It's a little bit of both. I would probably say that like most of the scenes that are represented in that Kickstarter video are scenes from the actual series that we're putting together. In terms of like actual shots, like you might not get the exact shot because the stuff still needs to be edited. A lot of that is from like the experimental stuff we put through. The pilot, which is complete by the time this comes out, should actually already be out. And part two that's kind of in the works.
Excellent.
There's a lot of good stuff in this film that I think fans of Larry's previous work would really enjoy. This idea of this crack military unit, that's a little bit underfunded, a little bit under budgeted, so they're a little bit, they have to improvise to get their goals met and stuff, are trying to investigate a series of high-tech assassinations. And they're torn between trying to bring the culprits to justice as well as to figure out whether there's a larger conspiracy going on. Part of the results of our experimental shoots was this idea of like, if we incorporated this reality show element into it, it can kind of help us in a lot of different ways. It can help us with that type of embedded, gritty feel, like pseudo found footage, but you don't have the, you don't have to like justify why this footage was found by, you can just simply say it's an embedded reality crew. And it kind of adds to the overall futuristic world we're creating, where like even a military unit needs to kind of like sign over rights and have a camera crew follow it just so it can make payroll.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really unique feel, and I'm really excited to share it with everybody when the pilot actually comes out.
Yeah, because I think, instead of following the usual sort of methodology of cinematic dramaturgy, to really experiment with how the story is told with the footage that's supposedly like an embedded camera person and surveillance footage and the expansion of surveillance footage. And also there's technology within the story that are sort of these little drones that fly around that are also camera equipped. And we see their point of view. And then a lot of it is about androids that are becoming sentient. And, we see through their eyes, a point of view also. So the point of view is always switching between these, and the parameters of the point of view and even the visual quality of the different point of views and the aspect changes. I really like that because it really loosens up and expands how you could actually tell the story. It's great. It's a whole new thing. A lot of new stuff to explore. And as we get the stuff on its feet, I think even more possibilities will open up. Because, as we did this, new stuff occurred to us.
There's this shot that anyone who's seen the Kickstarter videos will remember, where one of our characters actually looks right into the camera and says, cut that last scene out. Like, I don't want that scene recorded in the final edit.
Mm.
That scene, I think, when Larry and I kind of watched it played out, we're like, wow, like, that is such a interesting new way to do some character development, where you have this character, like, talking to the screen and saying, like, I don't want that in the final cut. There's so many implications about his personality and maybe the information that he discloses in that he has to tell the camera, I don't want it in, And it's an interesting third wall experience of, like, who's editing this and who's trying to, like, expose the truth.
And I think that's a thing that we're trying to explore, is that, like, okay, you show the version that he approved of, and then right after that you show from a different POV some surveillance footage that contradicts it.
So cool.
I mean, and when you start thinking in those terms, the possibilities become really endless.
Mm. Yeah, that was cool. When the first time I came over after having put that together, like, and we were supposed to meet to film some of this Kickstarter video, but like, Larry, do you remember, like, we just kept going back and forth about how this kind of just changes the entire path of what we're trying to the story we're trying to tell.
Yeah, it's because necessity really dictated coming up with this.
Yeah,
a lot of times that's how these things work out. Some of the best stuff comes about that way. I didn't set out to write a completely silent issue of G.I. Joe because I thought a wordless issue was a good idea. It was because the book was late and we needed to like cut a couple of weeks out of the schedule. Mm. Yeah, the easiest way to do that was to like not have any lettering in it.
That is so badass, dude.
So, you know, we run into that all the time.
That is cool.
I got to say, before we get in with another question here, Mark, not kissing up or anything, I've seen many a Kickstarter video, and yours is by far one of the better ones, if not the best one I've seen, that tells you what's going on, what the project is, what you get. I thought it was well put together.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because it was like, obviously, it's the especially the first 30 seconds, it's like we have to hook people emotionally. And I think that that's not even going to be that hard by just simply explaining how this thing started, right? But I had a couple acquaintances on Facebook or on one of the G.I. Joe like Facebook pages say like, oh, my God, I'm almost as interested in the backstory and how you're going to make this as I am the actual premise of the final product. You know, it could be like a reality show within a movie / reality show.
We know from talking to Larry specifically in the past that you often say that you're kind of famous for it in Joe circles. Even you don't know how the end of the issue is going to wind up before you write it. What experiences like that did you guys have with this project? Are there any characters maybe that we should maybe be on the look for, you know, that surprised you as the process went through?
But that's an ongoing process. We're revising and chopping things out. The entire thing of really going with this reality show completely changed everything. We're having to really rethink a lot of stuff that we thought was pretty solidly set. So, and the more we put the robotic sentience, the androids becoming self-aware, and having free will and toyed with it and walked in their shoes, you know, the more we realize, oh, maybe some of the plot stuff is going to really have to radically change then to allow for this.
It's definitely like a contained story in a very interesting world that I think could hold a lot of other stories. But I think Larry's right in that. I mean, we haven't talked about this in a while, Larry, but I think that that final third act is going to be so interesting to go over again about how it gets revealed now that we're kind of like hit our stride with the visual style.
The thing is, we have stuff blocked out. We're also very open to switching gear and going off on a side spur. And I think a lot of people aren't. They're locked into, you know, getting from point A to point B to C. If we see a way to get to point E or F and skip B, we're not discounting that.
Earlier on in this conversation, we were talking about how, like, sometimes a character will seemingly only exist just to tell us a certain piece of information and maybe hit a plot point correctly, right? And we struggle to prevent that. We struggle to make sure that there's a little bit more meat on that. But, like, I think recently with this reality show concept and the way characters somehow, you know, occasionally will talk to the screen and we capture glimpses that they didn't want in the final cut, like, we kind of had this epiphany that we're like, wow, like, if we introduce this as a storytelling instrument, it almost cancels out the need for, like, character A and B, you know? And it's, like, it's liberating. We're like, holy cow, this could be really cool. Like, we don't need that because there's so many other ways we can reveal that information, and that person becomes redundant, and we can focus more on the interesting characters. Like, it's pretty fun.
It becomes an evolving piece, you know, rather than like being stuck with, you know, characters A, B, C, and D, and then you get them through plot points A, B, and C, and like in the third act, blah, blah, blah happens.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, if you look at the big picture at, you know, of a lot of soap operas or long running series, or even like, you know, movie series, you get, well, somebody drops out and they have to write out this whole character, and it changes the entire thing. You know the movie The Warriors?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the beginning, when they started shooting that, there was this character, I forget his name, but he had this like sort of leopard skin keffiyeh on his head. Mm-hmm. In the second week of shooting, he broke his leg. And he was like the leader of the Warriors.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah. And they had already shot the big gang conference scene, and they had to like write this guy out of the script and make another character the head warrior. and they pulled it off. And it was probably better. That's not a decision that any producer and director in the right mind would like arbitrarily choose to do in the second week of shooting.
Yeah.
You know? But
which, by the way, everybody here is aware.
Forced them to do it. They did it.
By the way, everybody here should be aware that Larry was in the Warriors, right? Everyone knows that?
Well, I think I ended up being in like two seconds of the credit sequence. The thing is, if you're open to doing having that in mind all the time, that, okay, we'll try out this character. And when that character is up there and living and breathing and walking around, and you go, wow, you know, there should be more of this character.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, you know, happens all the time, I think.
That's a really interesting segue to the format of this piece. Like, we had originally started off as like a 110-page script that we had been working through with the intent of it just being a full feature. But through these experimental films, it kind of like made sense once we started thinking about it. I don't know why we didn't consider it before, but like we kind of arrived at the idea of like, let's crank these out. Let's have shorter episodes, crank them out faster, throw stuff on the wall and kind of test it and see what works. And it's totally like conducive to the way Larry is used to working with his episodic work. And it allows us to get stuff out there faster. So it turned into transforming it into that.
Reading the Kickstarter description of what the story's about, I definitely like the fact that you've now made smartphones smarter. Now they're genius phones. And then the living wall flat screen. So we're kind of going out to that next step on the horizon for technology.
Yeah.
What are your main sources of inspiration? I mean, I can see clear signs of Terminator here. I can see clear signs of Blade Runner, Battlestar Galactica, 24. What is your main bucket that you're going for to get ideas from? Or is it just dreaming stuff up and saying, you know, that would be cool because that's what I thought of as a kid or something?
You're going to think I'm making this up on the spot, but I made those two things up on the spot to describe the Kickstarter campaign. You know, they're already become part of the concept. That illustrates how this stuff is done. By being forced to come up with copy for that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, where would the smartphones evolve to? You know, like, what, you know, people keep wanting bigger screens. Where does that go to? Mm-hmm. A lot of times, technology becomes self-limiting, you know, and as we've seen from, you know, looking at old issues of popular science from the 40s and 50s, you know, obviously we're not.
To the age of the flying car.
Yeah, yet. We're not, you know, driving around in flying cars.
I'm writing a letter about that to somebody. I'm not sure who yet.
Even if you look at like 2001, when that came out, the idea of like a telecom, you know, like doing a video call seemed pretty outrageous. Who knew that we'd have Skype? And it would be just stupidly common. Look at Clockwork Orange or even more recent movies where like their idea of like what a futuristic sound system, you know, was going to be like a tiny little cassette. You know, it was like still a cassette, but it was like really, really tiny. And, oh, wow, that's really cool, you know. But we couldn't even conceive of like, oh, they'd put it on a disc.
Yeah.
Or it's not even a disc anymore. It's just memory.
Yeah.
Because we were extrapolating off of what we had at the time, which was like tapes and phonograph records and things like that. A lot of times coming up with this stuff is taking a stab in the dark and extrapolating off of what we know. But like literally a week from now, somebody may come up with something that makes everything, the ways we think about things, like totally obsolete. That's amazing. And it's great. You know, I love it.
Yeah, that description is an interesting story. Like, it was ultimately what you read there is what Larry wrote, because mine was way too long. But I was like, yeah. But like, I had envisioned it almost as if it's like that reality TV show Cops, but set in the future. And I had tried to write this thing where the basic idea was that like it was Cops being filmed in like 2052, and they just thought it was going to be a camera crew following around this like cybercrime anti-android unit for like a month, And then it just so happened that this was the particular unit that stumbled upon this vast conspiracy to kickstart a android revolution.
Right. That just now led me to another idea, is that if you take that underlying concept that, okay, this unit had to, like, allow this embedding to go on because they needed the money because they were underfunded.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, well, what if there's another unit out there?
Right.
That sort of whose bailiwick or jurisdiction slightly overlaps.
They're better funded?
They're better funded. You know? Yeah. Or they're even, you know, less funded, so they've got to, like, have more embedding, you know? And then there's some sort of, like, ratings war going on.
Well, that would be cool, because your guys would be, like, the underdogs, and the other guys would be, like, the heavily funded favorites, and you guys always come out at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you don't really show it as much as, like, you know, infer it, you know, like, you know, they're walking through a room and the other show is playing on the TV or so, you know, rather than being on the nose and, like, you know, yeah, and just cutting to it, you know, it's just like, I love that myself when I see that movie where they, like, somebody walks past something and you realize, oh my God, that's, like, you know, whatever it is, that weird sort of recognition of it.
Larry, that'd be cool if our guys, like, you know, they see, like, the other unit on TV and they're, like, scowling because they are, like, better funded and have, like, they're sponsored by Pepsi or something like that. And our guys are, like, ragtag. That'd right. be cool.
And that's how this process is working and is continuing to work. It's very exciting because the fact that it evolves. It's, you know, it's not like, oh, well, we got through stage one. Now we just got to, you know, dog our way through stage two.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, hey, we're at stage two, but we don't know what the heck stage three is going
to
be.
Yeah.
Know?
But at the same time, I think it's still important to underscore the fact that, like, we have that ending in mind. It's just how we get there will be a kind of a nice ride.
Yeah. But it could change.
Yeah.
This is the first time that any part of the creative process has happened on our show. So we're actually pretty excited about it too.
Very cool.
Okay, so other cool things that I wanted to – I had a mental list of stuff that I really wanted to share because I think that, you know, as a geek myself, I'm like, that's pretty cool. And it's mentioned in the Kickstarter video too, but I can't stop talking about how cool it is that Larry is kind of the creative director for the – not just the characters, but the military costumes and the futuristic weapons and the drones and all of that, and that we're working with a prop fabrication house that is basically lending this production their entire warehouse of talent to, you know, when necessary, they will hand build stuff the way they did in 1975 for Star Wars. And in other times they will be using, you know, CAD software to design stuff in, you know, on the computer and have a 3D printer print it out in pieces for us to, like, assemble almost like Lego. And that process is just, I mean, we're literally in it right now. Larry's done a whole bunch of really cool helmet designs. We're trying to strike that that great balance between, like, well, this is wholly practical and it serves the needs of, you know, the film in terms of the action and being able to see what character is leading the team and stuff. So that is very cool to just be a part of and witness. And obviously, Larry being so visual and an artist too, we will look at stuff on the internet. We'll look at stuff on Pinterest. I've got a couple Pinterest boards that have all this inspiration. But nothing beats it when Larry's like, no, I'm thinking something like this. And he just takes out his paper and pencil and sketches something. And says, here, you keep it.
That's awesome.
Very cool stuff. Very, very cool stuff.
Definitely wanted to take some time to congratulate you guys already. I mean, your Kickstarter campaign is, I think it's at 41% after only a few days, which is amazing. So a big congratulations to you guys already. It's obviously resonating with some crowds out there and generating some big interest already, which is very cool to see. And I know you kind of talked a little bit about the pilot, I guess, for Protocol Deviation that you've mentioned on the Kickstarter page as well. And is that going to be in any way like the same universe as Ghost Source Zero, or is that a wholly different kind of separate project?
Oh, that's it.
That's it. Okay.
As far as I know.
No. So it's an episodic format type of thing. Like the pilot episode for Ghost Source Zero is going to be Protocol Deviation. And it's going to kind of continue from there.
Yeah, it introduces our central character and his team and what he's been tasked to do and what he thinks is the right thing to do. It introduces the camera crew. As a almost as a character, And, you know, our hope is, should this Kickstarter go well, we can start to increase the scope of this world and show a lot more than we talk about. We have a stunt crew that did some work in the pilot that is dying to do more work. The main fight choreographer is based in Philly. Jay recently got a whole bunch of wire rigging training, so we're really excited to do that.
Nice.
And so, yeah, it is the same universe and kind of step one into the world. So hopefully that will resonate with people and they'll kind of dig what we've done and definitely get a hint of like, wow, where these guys can go with, you know, the right resources.
It's terrific. I know I've just been really impressed with what you've shown so far, from especially your little shots from the specialist's warehouse, just all the different weapons, all the different resources you guys have. That's just
reminds me
amazing.
Of the Matrix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's rare that you get on a Kickstarter video and everyone seems giddy. But really, just the word that kept sticking in my mind watching you two guys eat frozen yogurt and play with toy guns. And I just like, it's like this is a project that if you're not interested in this sort of thing at all, I'd want to see it just because of the fun you guys look like you're having.
You got to have fun doing it. And, you know, we've chosen something where we're like, we like all the stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so like, you know, rather than, oh, well, we only like this one aspect of it. When I was writing a lot of comics, I'd always ask the artist, well, you know, what do you like to draw? You know? And, you know, I Herb Trimpey would say, I like airplanes and motorcycles. So I would like put lots of airplanes and motorcycles. you get that enthusiasm back. That everybody is doing something they like to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's really important because we, as the budget might seem high to some people, but in Hollywood standards, like, this is really just peanuts. And I think that, like, it's a great approach, this micro budget approach of just having a small camera with a minimal crew and, you know, putting as much money in front of the camera as possible in terms of production value and props and actors. But the reality is, like, it is hard work. And it's not like there's fantastic craft services and everyone has, like, you know, a trailer park they can go, you know, camp out in. Like, it is hard work. So it might as well be stuff that we're really into. We're lucky that there's a lot of the actors that have been in our work so far are big G.I. Joe fans or have worked with me in the past and just like the visceral, gritty action part of it. So it's important. It's really important to work on something you love, because at the end of the day, like, that's all you have.
My next question, I wanted to talk a little bit about the upcoming Death of Captain America novel.
Ooh.
I don't know if you want to transition a little. But, well, I mean, I have to say, in my own limited recollection, this is really, like, the third time I can remember, like, a major comic book story being adapted into a prose novel. And I just think it's fantastic. And, you know, this isn't me, you know, kissing up or anything, but I think, Larry, you're the best guy to do it. Because, I mean, I think you're the best one who can get the grasp. So I'm curious if you can share any insights, how you got it, or, you know, what exactly you're going to be doing with the story and if there's any new directions you're going to be taking it.
Well, I finished it, actually. I think it's coming out in March. Everybody sort of signed off on it. I think it actually fell to me because it was somehow behind schedule and there wasn't a lot of time to do it. And it was a very research heavy project because the core of the story is like a 22 issue arc with references to like 10 issues before it and a bunch of issues after that core arc. So you're talking about boiling down 30 something odd issues into a fairly short prose novel. It wasn't as if I was totally familiar with a lot of the characters involved. I had to go back and really do my homework, try to walk around in the shoes of those characters for a while. You know, the big challenge was trying to explain stuff. I mean, that's my problem, is that I'm a little bit obsessive compulsive about how things work to a degree. I just can't accept it that, like, the shield flying car just does it. You know, I had to know how and why, and you know, it's like, you know, in the comic, they just like they're just driving along on a street, and they all of a sudden it, you know, it the wheels fold up and it starts flying, and I, you know, what I'm thinking is like, well, wait a second, you got a steering wheel. How does that convert to, you know, aircraft controls? You know, I mean, and if it could do this hover mode stuff, then the aircraft controls really have to be sort of like rotary wing aircraft, like helicopter controls. You have to have like a cyclic and stuff like that. And like, how does that work? If the thing could fly because the wheels turn sideways so that whatever it is that like causes it to have lift is facing downwards, then how does it get to that point without like falling to the pavement? <You know? laughs> Those were like big stumbling blocks for me because I had to actually sit down and try to work that out. And if not actually explain it, figure out a convincing way to like cruise around it. You know, that's really sort of a satisfying part for me. Just keeping track of all those characters because, you know, there's, you know, during even that core 22 issues that it's based on, like just about every single character in the Marvel Universe, like dropped in for a cameo or something. I mean, there's like, you know, the funeral, the two wakes or something. And like, you know, everybody shows up. It says like, you know, a couple of words here or there, but and other characters show up for an entire issue and then and sort of disappear. So I, you know, had to like start making diagrams for myself and putting markers on charts and saying, oh, these guys are in this room and this is what's happening here. And these people are on the helicarrier, you know, and these people are in this place. Boy, that's really hard to keep track of. It was a real challenge. But once I started making the characters walk around and walking around in their shoes, I really got into it. You know, because they're characters I really hadn't ever played with that much within the Marvel Universe. Most of the characters I got to use during my run on Wolverine were X-Men related characters. And when I did the Avengers, it was a whole different lineup. So there was a lot of stuff to catch up on, but I had a really good time doing it, and I was very happy with the end product. Although I had to do it, and I think I had like 3.5 months, so I was pretty much working day and night on it, and it would have been impossible without the support I got from Marie Javens, who's my editor on the project. And she was just very understanding, very helpful. Lots of people don't realize how much support you need from the editorial side to get some of this stuff done. The editors hardly ever get a shout out.
I got to read over his shoulder while he was typing, too.
Well, I was doing it a lot. At the same time, I spent a lot of time doing my own stuff, and you know, it really is true that, you know, any job you have fills up the amount of time you got to do it. There's really nothing like having a definite deadline to crack the whip on you. You know, you just know, well, you know, I got to do a chapter every 2 or 3 days or less and get through it. I'm very happy with it. We'll see. I'm the worst judge of my own stuff. I can't really tell. You know, I'm happy with it now, but I don't know how I'll feel about it in a month.
And that comes out in March, so we'll be looking for it.
Yes.
Hardworking man.
While you're writing this project, it's, you know, you're dealing with some very similar themes to what we saw with G.I. Joe. And of course, you know, you as the guy who wrote that stuff, Larry, and Mark as one of the prominent super fans of our little closet of guys. Were there any direct influences that you guys had as far as characters you wrote for this project that came from that old series? You know, was there a moment where you just said, yeah, that's a Snake Eyes moment, or that's a Gung Ho moment, or anything like that?
I don't know if there's any real sort of equivalence. The characters just sort of start to take over themselves. Mm. Well, you know, when I explained it, you know, like that most G.I. Joe characters are based on people I know. It's not like I start, I said, okay, this is who this is, and then blammo, this is his character. It's just like, okay, I've got this sort of character who's a blank slate, who's walking around. And as I develop that character, you know, like I realize, oh, he's sort of like that guy that I know. You know, it's like I could use that guy as a template. When I say template, it's basically about, oh, you know, it's like he wouldn't say that or he wouldn't do that. He'd have this attitude. So I know where it was going wrong. And I think that's what's at work here when we get these characters up, and then we could, you know, feed off the actual performer. We could feed off of how that triggers other stuff in us. And gives us references, you know, it becomes this ongoing thing, because that's how a lot of the G.I. Joe characters developed. They start out being a lot blanker, and they get filled in, and sometimes they veer off a little from how they started. So it's like when I was handed Storm Shadow as a figure, it was just, oh, he's the Cobra Ninja, he's a bad guy. You know, and I thought, well, wait a second. He's the only Asian character in this whole thing, and he's a bad guy. I think I'll just change him into a good guy over the course of events. Or,
oh, you know, my God. Mind blown over here.
But if you go back and look at it, you can see that happening. The way these characters grew out of a chance situational thing.
Yeah.
I get to page 16 or 17 of issue 21, and both Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow get their sleeves cut. And I said, oh, you can see their forearms. Like, wouldn't it be cool if they both had the same tattoo?
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun.
Well, what should I put there? Well, like, back in Iron Fist, I put an I Ching hexagram on Lei Kung the Thunderer, you know, who was a character in Kunlun. And I thought, oh, well, that's an easy symbol to remember because it alternates broken and solid lines. Mm-hmm. And as long as I remember that the broken line is on top, I can do that. And that's, you know, it's just straight lines. It's a lot easier to draw than Spider-Man's stupid costume.
Stupid.
You know, maybe stupid is not the right word, but everybody has ever had to draw Spider-Man. It's like,
it's at least a little frustrated. Yeah.
Oh my God, this webbing! And you have to, like, you know, make it follow the anatomy, and, like, you know, and there are people that, like, count how many verticals there are, so you got to get those right.
Gosh.
And I could never remember which way those legs of the spider bent. You know, I would keep doing it wrong, and I have to go back and correct it. So the whole idea of having a symbol that was, like, easy to remember and easy to draw was very appealing. So they both got the I Ching hexagram number 63 tattooed on their arms. And I had no idea what it meant or why they both had the same tattoo or what the tattoo meant. But 5 issues later in number 26, I had to make all that stuff up. So, and I had no idea what it was until I got to issue 26.
So, and you felt better about not going with the Hula Girl tattoo.
There's a funny story about the tattoo, because you were telling myself and James Cavanaugh and Dave Tree when we were in the UK how someone came up to you, I think, and they had the tattoo and they were very proud of it. And they showed it to you and you're like, you did it upside down.
I don't think I actually told the guy that.
I don't know if it was upside down, but I know you told us in the story it was upside down.
Yeah. I didn't tell the guy, but, you know, it was like,
he knows God. Now.
It's like, it's you know, it's like these people that have, you know, Chinese characters tattooed on their, you know, and they, you know, and they have no idea what it means.
It, like, says, like, I'm a taco in Chinese.
Right. Or something a lot worse.
The eagle that soars is actually the low-flying vulture.
Yeah.
Or the throbbing sphincter or something. Yeah.
There's a sound bite. Oh,
yeah. Wow. But yeah, you've seen people. I mean, God, I think there's entire sites about bad ink.
Yeah, that's true.
Where people have like an entire slogan in like ornate Gothic lettering, you know, and it's misspelled.
Perhaps the most famous one is "No Regrets," and "Regrets" is spelled wrong.
Right. I remember the first time I actually saw a G.I. Joe tattoo. I went to the JoeCon at Norfolk, Virginia.
2002.
Yeah. And this guy comes up to me wearing like this complete Cobra Commander outfit. and he stands in front of me and he doesn't say anything and he starts to take his clothes off. You know, which is kind of like
security.
This is before James Kavanaugh started coming to conventions, folks.
I need an adult.
Yeah, so he takes off the tunic and his shirt, you know, and he reveals this Cobra sigil about the size of a Voight basketball. Ooh. On his chest. It went from one side of his body to the other. And it was like, you know, these big areas are solid red. And I thought, oh, my God, that must have really hurt. And at least it was really well done.
It probably got him on a list somewhere, too.
But since then, I've seen hundreds, maybe thousands of them. You know, people make a real point of showing me these things. And lots of times they're in very odd places.
And considering most are guys, I'm sure that's really comfortable. Yeah.
I've seen a number of girls.
I bet you have. I never doubted that, but I figure most are guys.
Oh, yeah. Up in Calgary, I saw a whole bunch that were pretty amazing. So one girl that had Scarlet on one calf and Baroness on the other.
Oh, nice.
How did we get off on this tangent?
We're talking about the Arashikage symbol.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I could probably get us off it real quick and bring up another mention of something promoting one of your future appearances, since we are a G.I. Joe podcast. We did want to make mention that you will be appearing, Larry, at JoeCon in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts, anything you plan on talking about, maybe early ideas of a panel that you're going to do that you maybe want to share with us to give everyone a preview of what to expect from Larry at JoeCon?
I have no idea.
Okay, there we go. They're just like every comic book he wrote, folks. He's going in the JoeCon just like that.
Hey, just like us. So,
I would have so much anxiety if I knew what I was supposed to be doing. I'm much better if I have no idea what's going to go on and I just get up there and wing it. It's sort of like playing a blues solo. If you try to memorize an entire thing, you just it won't come off. You just like just do it. The stage fright and anxiety is worse than almost anything. You know, you get up there and you're like looking at all these people sitting there, and you have no idea what you're going to say. But if you think about that, it's even worse. Yeah. So I just don't think about it. Yeah.
There must be a lot of pressure on you, Larry, to feel like it's like an audience of adults whose childhoods you have shaped in some shape or form.
Is it?
I don't know. I'm asking you. It must be. I don't know.
Oh, great. Now you got him thinking, Mark. Come on now.
Just picture him naked, Larry.
You don't want to do that.
Yeah, but, you know, it wasn't like I set out to do anything other than...
It was an accident.
Yeah, well, you know, I really was the absolute last person they asked, you know, and, you know, because I had the last office in the row. They started at the other end of the building, and everybody else turned it down, literally. I've said it a dozen times that, you know, if they had offered me Barbie, I would have taken Barbie. I was just, I couldn't get any other work at Marvel, even though I was a full editor there. The editors were all writers. And they said, well, you're an artist. I said, well, let me write something. They would say, well, no, you're an artist. does not fit your job description or something. you have to understand that at that time, doing what they called, quote, a toy book, unquote, was the kiss of death. That was the lowest rung. In fact, the page rate was lower on licensed properties because they had to pay for licensing. They took that right off the top. And nobody wanted to do it. The artists especially, you know, it's like, you know, you think, oh, everybody would jump at the chance to, like, draw the Avengers or, you know, the Justice League. But, you know, if you look at it from the practical point of view, from the artist's viewpoint, you know, they'd go, God, there's like 10 people in that team. I gotta, like, you know, that's a lot of reference. I gotta, like, you know, look up all those costumes and get all those costumes right. And then I got to do crowds of people all the time. The perfect book from the artist's point of view is, you know, the nun in the coal bin, you know, or the polar bear on the ice cap. The less you have to draw, you know, the better. And if you got a huge crowd, boy, it's like eats away at your profit. So nobody wants to do it. And people told me right out, they say, like, well, don't take that book. You know, like, you know, if you get associated with doing the toy books, you won't get any other, you know, A-list work ever. And they were pretty much right. I was never offered an A-list book while it was an A-list book.
That's all right. So some people have to go out and create the A-list books.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. That's right.
We're looking forward to seeing you at JoeCon again. Thank you very much for accepting that invitation. Mark?
Yes, sir.
Let's have you promote the Kickstarter page. I don't know if you guys have any Facebook pages, Twitter feeds, any social media sites that you want people to hit up to learn more about you and your company, your production company, or the film, or sure, just anything in particular. Go. It's all you.
Absolutely.
Go
ahead, Mark. Thank you. Thanks for having us, you guys. The best place to go to get information, and it's the easiest to remember, is our production company, Planet Nerd Rage Productions. It's on Facebook. You should look us up. You'll see the link there to the Kickstarter, which is a really long URL, so it's probably pointless for me to verbally list it here, but I'll give it to the guys available on the podcast webpage. But I want to thank you guys for having us. We're naturally very excited. We think Joe fans will be excited. And, you know, I wanted to bring this up because I know Larry won't, but it's like Larry he's helped create fantastic brands that have left an indelible imprint on so many of us. We think that this is a great idea, and one of the differences here is that Larry owns part of this property. He's not just a salaried staff guy, and anybody who has followed kind of that golden age of comics will know that he and his friends like Neil Adams have been strong proponents of creator-owned projects and intellectual property that kind of, in a way, you know, puts the rewards and the fruits of that labor in the rightful hands of some people, and I think that that's noteworthy. And it's been absolutely fantastic working with Larry. You can imagine it being like a geek's dream. And I think in a lot of ways it's even better because it's been such a learning experience. It's not just hanging out with like a cool guy or hanging out with like how you would imagine hanging out with Fonzie. It is learning and growing and witnessing creativity happening. And it's amazing. So, you know, if anything, if you don't even – you don't even donate to the Kickstarter, I would hope that you leave hearing us out and experiencing a little bit of that magic happen, because it really is magical for me.
Hey folks, there's not much show product on the shelves right now. Take your $10. At least $10, right? Because you're going to get a copy of the DVD, right?
Get a copy of the show for, you know, none of this is a donation. It's all a pre-order. That was one thing that went.
There you go.
We sat down, Larry and I were just very adamant about, like, this isn't a handout for us. This is the lowest tier you get a copy of the show.
You can't beat that. But if you feel like you want to give more, definitely give more. I mean, there's no Joe product out there, folks. Give it to somebody that deserves some attention.
Right.
Definitely. And I mean, they've got rewards on here for some really, really special things, you know, unopened G.I. Joe action figure signed by Larry Hama, you know, a signature and photo of him holding that action figure. You can get a Blu-ray disc. You can have a meet and greet. There's just all sorts of great rewards that are available throughout the different tiers of the Kickstarter Kickstarter campaign. So definitely get out there and take that money you were going to spend on G.I. Joe toys this year and put it to this instead.
You're here. Yeah, my Facebook page is actually full, but I have a Facebook fan page that's called Larry parentheses been faking it all my life close parentheses Hama, and I've only got like about 1,000 likes on it, so I could use more.
Absolutely, we'll get that linked up.
Trying, I'm there with my little Cookie Monster face.
Jesus. Oh, get a real picture, Mike. Oh.
Oh, come on, man. I'm ugly.
We know that, but I'm sure Larry doesn't have 50 people already like that on his Facebook page.
No.
No, not at all.
No.
So as always, big thanks to Mark and big thanks to Larry for joining us tonight. It's always a blast to have you guys on. I'm really thrilled to see this evolve. I think the project just looks just from a pure entertainment standpoint, looks fantastic. I love Mark's mentality about creator-owned and just thinking about what Larry's done for brands over the years. Kind of interesting how we talked about how he's taken brands that weren't necessarily A-list and turned them A-list. And I foresee the same thing happening with this, and I'm really looking forward to kind of seeing it transpire. So everybody go out to Kickstarter. We'll be putting the full length in the show notes for sure. I'll be promoting the heck out of it. It's still got 32 days to go. As of this recording, it is about 41% funded already. So I think we can really push this through and get something very cool happening. So thanks, Mark. Thank Larry for joining us tonight. And look forward to hearing more about this as time goes on.
Great. Thank you for having us. Love it.
No problem. Anytime.
All right. Anytime. Seriously. Project, no project. You want to read some crazy manifesto? You want to read the ingredients list on some mashed potatoes? What's on Joe's mind? We'll answer.
All right, folks. Good night.
Take care, guys.